Hey, it's Francis. Thank you so much for making the Splendid Table part of your life all year long. This public media podcast is only possible because of you. You generously welcome us into your kitchens, and we do our best to provide support and inspiration along the way. So please, donate before Memorial Day weekend to support our show. Go to splendidtable.org/donate, and thank you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So, many years ago, I taught a class to college students that I called How Being a Better Cook Can Make You a Better Writer. And basically, it was about the fact that, you know, as you learn to cook, you learn to see more and more details in what you're doing and what the food's doing. And, you know, one of the things that makes for better writing is that ability to see details and to bring them out. It gets to the whole, you know, you can see the whole world in a grain of sand thing. And today, we've got a show that's all about taking something that seems straightforward and learning to look inside it to see much more. And maybe that all sounds a bit abstract, but it'll be tasty, I promise. We have flavor scientist Arielle Johnson talking about her fantastic new book, Flavorama, A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. And first, we have one of the most dedicated chroniclers of the chef world that I know of, Andrew Friedman. For more than 20 years, he's written with and about chefs and what makes them tick, but his new book, called The Dish, shines a light on a wider world. He takes a single dish from one night in a restaurant and tells the story of all the people who had to come together to bring diners just that one plate of food. Hey, Andrew, it's great to see you.
Francis, great to see you. Thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. So, you know, you've written about chefs and the culture of restaurant chefs for a long time. I think you've written or co-written over 30 books.
That's
with
true.
Or about chefs, plus your blog, plus a podcast. So how did you get into this subject?
Well, as they say, it happened quite by accident. The quick version is that longer ago than I want to say, I was trying to be a screenwriter, and I had a day job as a publicist with, just by pure happenstance, was the top restaurant PR firm at the time in New York City. And I knew nothing about that scene, but all of a sudden I was representing people like Alfred Portale when he was at the Gotham Bar and Grill, a 24-year-old Marcus Samuelson when he was appointed the chef of Aquavit, Rocco DiSpirito when he was the toast of the town at a restaurant called Union Pacific. And I just got very interested in that world. Before too long, a lot of my best friends were people who spent their nights in kitchens. And Alfred and I had become especially tight. And he asked me to co-author the Gotham Bar and Grill cookbook with him, which, in all honesty, I thought it would just be a one-off, just because he and I had a rapport, and he felt like I really got his voice. But I'm not even kidding when I say this. I did not own a single cookbook when I did that book. And that book did great. We won the IACP Award for Chef Cookbook. We were nominated for Best General Cookbook at the Beards. And, you know, I saw an opening. I saw an opening to maybe not put on a suit and tie and go to an office and have clients and manage people. And I quit my job and I started looking for other projects.
Yeah. So, okay, this is probably like the mid-late 90s, I would guess, that happened?
Yeah, the Gotham book came. It's really weird. I always forget. It came out in either 97 or 98.
That is unusual. And also, like, really, like, a heck of a start, because Alfred Portale was a towering figure in the New York restaurant scene. No pun intended, because he's actually the person who was credited with inventing the plating style where you stacked food. And so when people talk about tall food and, you know, when that style became all the rage, you know, for 10 years or more, like, that was essentially his invention, right?
He's credited with it. I guess it probably was. It definitely, I can say
popularized it, at least, yeah.
Oh, for sure. I mean, no, I think it was his. He told me a funny story. I don't know if people even, I mean, it's hard for people, I think, today to understand how big a restaurant like Gotham was because, you know, it was born in the early 80s and there just weren't that many big, important restaurants around. So, you know, when I was with Alfred, he was, like you say, he was one of the biggest chefs in the United States. But he told me a funny story. He had been a jewelry designer before he became a chef. And when he was staging, you know, working, you know, in Europe to just gain knowledge, you know, as an unpaid laborer, he was working for the great French chef Michel Gérard, and he was playing with a salad one day, and he started sort of stacking the leaves. And Gérard apparently said to him in French, "Is your father an architect?" So that was, I think, the beginnings of the whole thing. But it definitely reached a point where he would have happily not had to do interviews about it anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure. But also, I mean, just for listeners to remember, like, if this is the mid-late 90s, this was really kind of a different time in American food culture, certainly in how we thought about chefs. Like, the average person probably had not heard of many chefs. They weren't, like, a figure in our pop culture. I mean, this is right when the Food Network was really taking off. And I think that was what really sort of mainstreamed the idea of chefs as cultural figures and things like that. So let me ask you this, though. You know, what keeps you interested in that world this many years later?
You know, it's funny. Not anymore, but for about a decade, I also did quite a bit of writing about tennis, which is just a personal passion for Tennis Magazine. And, you know, tennis players' biographies, you reach with most of them, you get to like age 12, and it's all the same. You know, like they go to an academy, they start playing in what we call the minor leagues of tennis, you know, the challenger circuit, and amassing ratings points, and then playing, you know, main tour events. And that's kind of like every tennis player, just about. Chefs, I mean, as you know, Francis, the ways of getting to being a chef, you know, there's an infinite number of paths for people. There's an infinite number of backgrounds you can come from. You know, are you self-taught? Did you decide to go to culinary school? Did you wander into it through a high school dishwashing job? Or did you grow up, you know, we can say this now, you know, admiring chefs and wanting to be a chef, sure. You know, from you knew what they were, you know? So there's just so many different stories, you know, and I'm trying to get the phrase to catch on. It never has. I'm the only person who uses it. I think people still think it's weird, but you know, I don't call myself a food writer. I call myself a chef writer. You know, I haven't written a recipe in over a decade, for an article, for a book. I mean, I really haven't. I have always been in my own writing, interested in the people. I mean, that is really what interests me. So that keeps it constantly fresh. And, you know, anyone who reads, I don't even think you have to read a website like Eater. I mean, if you read, you know, the New York Times or the LA Times or the San Francisco Chronicle or the Chicago Tribune, then you know, there have been many sea changes in the restaurant industry over the last decade or so.
Sure.
And that, as someone who's been around long enough to have been there when, you know, the whole celebrity thing was kind of cresting, that's also been very interesting. You know, some of it's been very dark and depressing, you know, and awful, you know, this exposure of all these bad actors. Which needed to happen. But, you know, kitchen culture is changing. The breadth of chefs who are getting attention has changed for the better. I mean, you and I both go out to the Beard Awards, I think, most years. And, you know, even just the last 3 or 4 years, you know, the visible difference in the makeup of who's there, you know, and who's winning awards and who's being celebrated. You know, it's been terribly exciting for me to have seen all of that. So that's a long answer, but there's a lot there, you know, and that's all kept me very engaged. Plus, I like to eat good food.
Yeah, that part's a given. So I want to get into your latest book, which is, you know, sort of another in your line of books about chefs, and there's still some of the main characters, but so is the dishwasher and the delivery truck driver. So Actually, I will intro the book for you. Why don't you describe the concept of this book for us, The Dish?
Sure. The Dish, the subtitle of the book is The Lives and Labor Behind One Plate of Food. Mm-hmm. And it is, I took one dish at a restaurant in Chicago and wrote about basically all of the key people whose lives and work come together in that one plate. So in the restaurant, you meet everybody from the dishwasher to the line cooks to the sous chef to the chef de cuisine to the chef owners to the server. And then beyond the restaurant, mm-hmm. You meet the farmers and a rancher and a vintner, because there's a red wine reduction on the plate, whose wares, for lack of a better word, are present on the plate. But then you also meet a field worker. You also meet and spend a day with a delivery truck driver from one of the farms. And the book takes place during a dinner service. So mm-hmm. instead, it's not just a series of profiles, but the sort of connective tissue of all of that is you're essentially following one dish from the time the server gets the order at a table to when the chit, or some people might call it a ticket, goes into the kitchen, and then you kind of follow the various components of the dish as they're being readied. And as that happens over about 75 minutes, because we're dealing with basically a main course, as each element of the dish is being handled or manipulated, you get a breakaway profile either of the cook who's dealing with it or of the farm or the ranch or the vineyard from which it comes.
We'll be back to talk more with Andrew Friedman, author of The Dish, The Lives and Labor Behind One Plate of Food. And then we are turning to the wacky world of Flavorama with flavor scientist Ariel Johnson. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking right now about the many lives that contribute to create a single plate of food with Andrew Friedman, author of The Dish. Let's get back to it with him. So tell us about some of the people you were really struck by, who you really wanted to write about. And I love that it's not just the chef whose name is on the door.
Thank you. First of all, you know, dishwashers, I've mentioned it a minute ago. Mm-hmm. That is a job that, as I've spent time in kitchens for the last 20 plus years observing, that job, I think, is the most undervalued and misunderstood by the general public, if they even think about it ever for a second.
Mm-hmm.
It's any chef will tell you that if the dish pit goes down,
the restaurant goes down.
It's over.
Yeah.
It's over. You know, it's obvious, right? If you don't have plates. And I don't even know if it registers for most people that plates are recycled throughout a dinner service. You know, in old movies, there was that trope, you know, if you couldn't pay for dinner, they'd make you stick around and wash dishes as like barter for your meal. But that's not how it works. You know, the way it works is a dish is cleared and it's, you know, it's cleaned, it's sterilized, it's hand dried usually. It's polished, you know, they rub out any little spots and whatnot at a restaurant like the one in the book.
Yeah.
And then it's returned to the Speedway, you know, like when you walk into a restaurant, the plate someone's eating their main course off of might very well be the plate that you're going to eat yours off of.
Yeah,
right?
Sure, right.
So in addition to the fact you need the plate, it also has to be spotless. It has to be sterilized. That's even a bigger concern, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
The other really interesting thing to me is that, you know, I don't know the exact percentage, but let's say half of these people who do that job they're probably lifers, you know, they're people who do that. And a lot of chefs will try their hardest to bring dishwashers with them from restaurant to restaurant if they'll come along, because it's such an important thing.
Yeah.
But the other piece of it is that it's the most common entry point to the profession. The number of people who, including many of the best chefs we ever had in this country, who started just wanting to earn a little money in high school and fell in love with the environment and then became interested in food, that's a huge population,
yeah,
a huge percentage rather of our chefs. But in the book, there's a woman named Blanca Vasquez.
Yeah.
She's from Ecuador. She does not speak English. The kitchen at the restaurant is upstairs. It's an open kitchen. It's on the same level and it's visible to the dining room. The only person during service who's working in the subterranean level is Blanca.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say the people who own this restaurant are very, they're good people. They're very well liked and respected. They do a lot of altruistic work. So I'm not saying this at all as a criticism of them. It's kind of just the reality of the space where they happen to have this restaurant. But the dish pit is downstairs, and Blanca's kind of doubly isolated. You know, she doesn't speak English, and she's not
and she's
amongst
physically
the team.
Yeah,
she only sees people if they have to run down to the walk-in refrigerator to grab something or go to the dry storage area downstairs. She's on a different schedule. She comes in at, you know, a half hour before dinner service when even, everyone's already been there. Everyone's kind of in their rhythm. So a lot of her interaction with the team is limited to them all kind of going, hola, hola, you know, when she comes in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not a criticism of anybody. And she, you know, likes working for these guys. But getting her story was amazing. Well, she grew up in a very poor family. There were more than 10 children. I had to double check. I happened to speak some pretty good Spanish because I grew up in Miami, but I did the interview with a translator there, who was actually the general manager of one of the team's other restaurants. I had to double check the original Spanish because I wanted to be sure I had heard it correctly. But she was basically matched up with an older guy when she was 11 years old, because that was how, you know, that was how it was done. They needed to chart a future and who her family would be. And then she had three daughters. The guy, of course, left her, and she eventually came to the United States just to be able to send money back to her kids. It's a heartbreaking story. You know, it's the only interview I did for the book where somebody started crying. And this I didn't even realize, but, you know, I also interview a farm worker who's from Mexico in the book. And, you know, they, a lot of times where people end up when they come to this country is just complete happenstance. You know, Blanca just ended up in Chicago because she came with some friends and they were headed to Chicago. I mean, that's how she ended up in Chicago. I would think where she came from and what, you know, Chicago winter is like, you know, maybe somewhere more southern would have been more attractive. You know, she's done okay there. But the other fascinating thing I learned about her is one of the jobs that she held before she left to come to the United States was what she referred to as cocinera of a restaurant, meaning you know, that means cook, but she was basically the chef. I mean, it wasn't like the kind of restaurant that's in this book. It was kind of a, you know, an everyday family restaurant, I guess, mm-hmm, what we would call it here in the States. But that, you know, that's her backstory. And, you know, that's all fascinating. And that's, you know, just one person on the team there. And there's, I should say, there's a lot of, I mean, we've learned a lot, the general public's learned a lot about this in the last several years, and we have shows like The Bear now. Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of personal trauma in the backgrounds of people who end up in kitchens, you know? There's quite a bit of that in this book, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of kind of people who were picked on. And it's really... you know, to me anyway, as much as I already knew that, the picture that emerged, you know, talking to all these people in some depth, really reinforced that reality to me.
Yeah. And I, and again, it's again, this is sort of what I find so, appealing about this book and this work, right? It's like, there was never a moment where that chef could be there if Blanca wasn't there. Right.
No. Like, yeah. You know, I think people in the restaurant industry know that.
Sure.
You know, I vividly remember being at an early tasting for a pretty high-end restaurant a friend of mine was opening in Midtown Manhattan. And the general manager, they were training the front of the house staff, and they were also getting, you know, the dishes fine-tuned. And they were waiting for the food to be ready to taste. And the general manager of this very fancy restaurant said, how many people here were dishwashers earlier in their career? And even amongst the servers, it was a huge number. Mm. And the GM himself raised his hand and he said, you know, the dishwashers here are one of the most important people here. And if I ever see anybody here disrespecting them, it's over, you know? And I mean, something must have happened in his past that he felt the need to give that talk. But most of the team was just nodding in agreement, you know, because it's also a really tough physical job.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah, and you know, it's as nonstop as cooking is during a service.
Yeah, I mean the the plates are flying, the water's hot, but yeah, it's. You know, it's something to say, oh, it's an important cog in the machine. But I think what's important for us to recognize is like, oh, there are no cogs. It's not a machine. They're all people. Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Francis.
Andrew Friedman is the author of The Dish, The Lives and Labor Behind One Plate of Food. So speaking of the people behind the chef who make the magic happen, I am so excited to get to introduce Arielle Johnson to you. She is a self-described flavor scientist. I'll let her tell you what that means. And she works in some of the top kitchens of the world to help restaurants make their food more flavorful or even to literally create new flavors. That's what she did for years at Noma, considered to be the best restaurant in the world by many. And her new book, Flavorama, brings all that knowledge to the home kitchen. Hey, Arielle, it's great to see you.
Hi, Francis. Amazing to see you.
I am so happy to talk to you. I know I remember we started talking about this book a while ago. So I am so happy that we are here to get to celebrate your book, Flavorama.
It's been a bit of a slog, but I'm super excited to share it with you and like love talking about it with people. So.
Right. A bit of a slog is always a nice way to introduce your new baby.
Oh, God.
It's a bit of a slog.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the honesty.
Well, it was a slog to write it so that it's not a slog to read it.
Right. So, Arielle, I have to start by asking you this, even though we've known each other for years, but what is a flavor scientist and what does one do?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I suppose the very simple answer is that a flavor scientist is a scientist who works on the subject of flavor. I I mean, I use the term flavor scientist mostly so I don't have to give a paragraph long explanation when people ask what I do. But I'll give that to you now. Sure. Yeah, I went to school after I got my bachelor's degree in chemistry. I specialized in food and wine chemistry for my PhD. I did that at UC Davis in the wine department, the Department of Viticulture and Enology. So technically, my main academic focus has been chemistry, but even to do my research as a scientist on flavor, we do chemistry, we measure molecules, but flavor doesn't really exist until someone puts food in their mouth and perceives it. So we've already added sensory analysis onto that. Sensory analysis is basically very formalized taste testing. So I would do that with panels of volunteers to try to answer deep questions about flavor and then bring in chemistry into the picture as well. And since I've done those things, I've incorporated a lot of information from different disciplines. So, you know, I have a little bit of knowledge in like ethnobotany, a little bit in, you know, food history and anthropology, a fair amount in fermentation and microbiology, a lot from, you know, other aspects of cooking and the kitchen. So, in part because so many different things affect flavor. The genetics of a plant can affect flavor, but the environment that it grows in can also affect it. But then the things that you do as a cook can change flavor. That there's not really like one discipline like just chemistry or like just psychology that covers it. So flavor scientist, I think, tries to just cover all bases for how I work with and explain flavor.
Yeah, no, I love that. And there's so much you talk about that's so interesting to me. Like one of which, you know, you just mentioned flavor doesn't really exist until someone puts a thing in their mouth and perceives it. And yes. I think that's almost like a philosophical sort of question, really. Because like on some level, it's like, I've always wondered this, like what I see is the color blue. Like, am I sure that you see that color the same way I do? I have no idea, you know? And so maybe flavor, there's probably some... sort of analog to that with flavor, but I don't mean this to like go down
metaphysics.
Like,
yeah,
yeah. You know, what is the earth if not our perception? Philosophical conversation with you.
Yeah, don't get me started because I will talk about that for a while.
So let's pretend that sweet to me is sweet to you, and so on and so forth. How did you become interested in this subject?
Well, I mean, flavor is an attractive subject. Because I like delicious things, so there's that kind of like natural interest. I'm also like very, very drawn to puzzles and systems that interact with each other and sort of gray areas in life. Flavor is this interesting thing where it's very much a like molecular phenomenon. When you are sensing flavor, you are literally sensing molecules. So there's like real bits of tangible matter that are, you know, interacting with your senses. But then that gets translated and mediated through different parts of your brain into a completely different animal than what you study with chemistry. So the kind of interplay between the hard science, the like measurable molecules and chemicals and things like that, and the more aesthetic and experiential and emotional and cultural aspects of flavor. The fact that they like go together all the time. And so you have to kind of use every tool and way of thinking that you can to study it was just very exciting to me.
Yeah. It's so interesting too, because like, I mean, I don't think there's probably anything that is objectively pleasurable and objectively not pleasurable, right? So, I mean, I think of this because you brought up the idea of culture, how culture impacts flavor. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's culture? Culture is kind of like training on how to be like sort of a person in the world, right?
And yeah, exactly. It's like a bunch of shared experiences that people have. Yeah.
Right. So like sweetness, I've heard like, oh, well, sweetness signifies sugar and the body wants calories. So like sweetness is always going to be attractive, things like that. But, you know, the flavor of a durian, you know, tastes amazing mm-hmm. to one person and is repulsive to another. And, you know, that's, mm-hmm. there's no objective reason for that, right? It's exposure, it's culture, it's personality.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially, I mean, so a lot of flavor is actually smell. So if you're talking about the flavor of a durian, the sort of specifics of it have a lot to do with aroma. And yeah, I mean, you know, if we're saying there's no such thing of as like objectivity in smell, like that's literally true. Like our brain is set up to process smell in a way that's very individualistic. What I mean by that is like when you smell a smell, you kind of pass the signals from your smell receptors through the like emotional and memory parts of your brain. And, you know, I guess the classic example is like Proust and his Madeleine, and that smelling the Madeleine brings him back to, you know, remembering things past. That's literally how it works in the brain. So you are built to like associate strong emotions and memories with smells, and to then recall them the next time you like smell or, you know, eat the same thing.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, to get super technical, the olfactory bulb, which is one of the things that collects the signals from smell, is very, very closely connected to the limbic system, which is, you know, structures like the amygdala that we use for kind of the deepest levels of emotion.
Did I wake up this morning and think, I'm going to talk about the olfactory bulb today? And the answer is no. I didn't wake up thinking that, but I'm glad we are. Okay, so let's go into the book, Flavorama. There's much more I want to ask you.
Okay.
But, you know, so your book is really meant for both people interested in science and, I think, cooks, right? Like,
oh, yeah,
there is something about understanding the science of flavor and how that can impact your cooking or improve your cooking. So I love that your book is set up as sort of explorations of what you call the four laws of flavor. So I'm not aware that these are laws that existed before you coined them. So congratulations on being a legislator as well as everything else. So the first law of flavor, according to Ariel Johnson, is flavor is taste and smell.
Yes.
So I think we understand this, but give us a little like the before the court, you are now going to argue this.
Well, so yeah, so this is flavor is taste and smell. But you know, if you're not a flavor scientist, usually you think of flavor as just taste. So we even talk about like whether something tastes good or not, or this this tastes like chicken, etc. But smell
this tastes
is
like
a
chicken
huge...
must be your absolute favorite thing to hear.
Well, I mean, I can find the molecules that smell like chicken if we want to talk about those in further detail. But I have a little bit more focus on red meat. But yeah, it's similar mechanisms. Okay, so there's five basic tastes: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. So in your cooking, working with flavor, it's often like important to get those right as a foundation. But then any other flavor you can think of, basically. Fruity or vanilla-y or roasted or garlicky, for example. Those are all sensations that we sense with smell, not taste at all. So the signals from taste and smell are combined in the brain. Smell is a huge component of flavor, and it's kind of a secret component of flavor for most people because we don't really notice that it's happening when we're tasting something. Yeah.
Unless you have a really bad cold and you try to eat dinner and you're like, why doesn't it taste like anything?
Well, when I started writing this book, I had to explain it a lot more. But now that most people have had COVID at least once, they understand, unfortunately, like when I had COVID and lost my sense of smell, food had no flavor at all. But so even with a cold where your nose is just blocked, you'll usually notice that everything tastes really muted and doesn't have a lot of flavor. What you are experiencing is just flavor minus smell.
We'll be back with more from flavor scientist Ariel Johnson in a moment. Stick around. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking to flavor scientist Ariel Johnson about her new book, Flavorama. Let's get back to it with her. I want to move on to the next law, but a little detour. You mentioned sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami.
Yes.
Spicy is a weird exception, right?
It is a very weird exception. So flavor is taste and smell. A small part of it is also touch. Mm. So when you taste a chili and you get a burning sensation on the inside of your mouth and it feels hot, that's because molecules in the chili are activating your heat and pain receptors. So those are quite literally fired off by a molecule called capsaicin. So that's the spicy molecule in chilies. So that's a sensation. It's part of flavor. We feel it inside our mouths, but we sense it with our sense of touch, not our sense of taste.
That's interesting. And okay, but then there's like, sometimes you eat like raw garlic and it feels very spicy. It's like, oh, that's hot.
Yes,
or like
yes.
Horseradish. Mm-hmm. Are those different things?
Yeah, there's actually like a few different ways ingredients can be spicy. Capsaicin and chilies, and then the spicy parts of like black pepper and ginger are pretty similar. The spiciness of garlic and allium, so garlic, onions, as well as things in the mustard family, so like mustard seeds, wasabi, horseradish, stuff like that. Those are spicy because of a defense mechanism in the plant, where when you like cut through the cells, two different components that are stored separately combine, sort of like two-part epoxy, and then create this like very, very spicy sulfur molecule that is both volatile, so it like it floats up to your eyes and makes you cry, but also, you know, in the mouth tastes spicy.
So this is botanically, the garlic is like, bugs want to eat me? Okay, well, peace out. You're going to bite me and you're going to hate it.
100%. That is how garlic and its relatives evolved its spicy, garlicky flavor. It's actually in botany referred to as the mustard oil bomb. That's the technical name for the spicy, the system that makes the spicy flavors in the garlic and horseradish.
Okay, the second law of flavor. This is fascinating. Flavor follows predictable patterns.
Yes. So, you know, I titled my book, or the subtitle of the book is A Guide to Unlocking the Art and Science of Flavor. So this law kind of is a bit more of the art than the science. And that comes out of, you know, having worked a lot in restaurants and like really great restaurants with really great chefs who are developing new things all the time and kind of coming to understand how they think about cooking and ingredients, and basically trying to give people a cheat code for how to gain those skills without, you know, becoming a professional for 15 years. But okay, we'll start with a specific example. If you have a recipe that includes like lemon juice and you run out of lemons, like what do you do? Mm-hmm. Do you like not make the recipe, or can you like kind of look at a lemon as a pattern of sourness? And then if you're able to then think of like what other ingredients have sourness in them, sure. You know, vinegar is an obvious one, but then ingredients like pomegranate molasses and pickles and kimchi, sumac, as well as like things like yogurt and creme fraiche. So there's a lot to be gained from being able to like look at patterns like here's a place where I use sourness, here are ingredients that are all sour or umami or fruity, etc. So yeah, I mean, I think of thinking of flavor in patterns as like the difference between following the turn-by-turn GPS in your car versus, like, understanding the geography and the traffic patterns of a city well enough that you can kind of find your own back routes and, you know, react to unexpected things like a parade that closes streets.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of a way to take matters into your own hands.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So let's go to the third law. And that is flavor can be concentrated, extracted, and infused. What you mean by that is, I think I should have written this down, but it's something like, this is like a line in your book, but paraphrase, but something like, most of cooking is really the act of moving flavor molecules around selectively.
Yes. And I know that sounds extremely esoteric, like let's magically move flavor molecules around. My favorite example of that is brewing a cup of coffee. So, you know, coffee beans, we figured out that, if you grow them and ferment them and roast them, they make these amazing flavors. But no one I know sits around crunching down on whole coffee beans just to experience that flavor. Long, long ago, we developed a method of adding hot water to crushed coffee beans and extracting the flavor molecules from the beans into the water. So a cup of coffee is an example of having moved the coffee flavor molecules around so that you can experience them in a much more pleasant texture and form.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, this is making me think things that both are like, oh, extremely new to me, but also extremely obvious to me.
That's, you know, good. Like, that's what it's supposed to do.
No, it's amazing. Okay, so your example of, okay, making a cup of coffee, I make a cup of coffee most days. But what if I switched out the water that I use to brew my little cup of coffee with oil? You know, just hypothetically speaking.
Yeah.
If I were to heat oil and have that soak through the coffee, then that would... that oil would now absorb coffee aroma, and so what we would think was coffee flavor, but without the bitterness, the acidity, like all the other components. But like now you have a concentrated substance that you can add coffee aroma to things if you wanted to.
Exactly. That's, yes. Another example like that, when I was in high school, I used to work in an ice cream shop. And we had two different versions of coffee ice cream on the menu. There was coffee, regular coffee ice cream, and white coffee. So coffee ice cream we made by brewing coffee and adding it to ice cream base. White coffee we made by soaking coffee beans in cream and then making that into ice cream. You know, cream is like 40% fat, so it is pretty similar to your example of using oil to make a cup of coffee instead of water. So, yeah, white coffee, it extracted fewer colors and like all of the aromas very well. So it was like a lighter colored, less bitter, less, you know, kind of tangy, acidic version of coffee ice cream, but then highly, highly coffee flavored in terms of aroma. By picking different things to infuse the coffee, we got two different expressions of the flavor of coffee.
That's great. Okay, so all this talk about coffee actually reminds me of a recipe you have in the book. And I think probably a great example we're talking about. And you make a smoked tea oil, which sounds extremely like fancy restaurant-y, but tell us how you use it.
Well, so I love the flavor of smoke. I love smoking foods. I have always lived in very small apartments in New York where there is no outdoor space to set up a smoker, and I can't put a smoker in the kitchen because it'll set off the smoke alarm and I'll lose my security deposit and it'll be like a nightmare all around. So, you know, some people get around this using liquid smoke. Liquid smoke is basically water infused with smoke. And, you know, I like that fine. It's like a little, I think it can get a little harsh. So I was thinking about, like, well, if smoke doesn't have to be in the form of smoke, like, what could I use to, make it more flexible? And, I just tried taking Lapsang Souchong tea. So it's like a smoked Chinese tea, which my dad used to drink when I was a kid. So, like, the smell of smoky tea is, like, deep in my, you know, early flavor memories. And I thought, like, well, you know, all of these aromas are going to be pretty soluble in oil. So let's see how much smoke flavor I can get in the oil. Infusing smoked tea into oil makes a very refined version of liquid smoke, let's say. So there's like not a lot of like sour flavors or anything acrid, but it's like very, very aromatically smoky. Yeah. And so that, of course, sounds like something that would, you know, get dribbled on a quail's egg and served as an amuse-bouche at a $500 meal. But I like to use it for doing like oil poached fish. So, you know, oil poached fish is like a really delicious way to cook fish, really gentle. But then if you do it with smoke oil, you get almost like a smoked salmon flavor without having to set up a smoker in your house.
That's amazing. I love that. Cool. Okay, let's go to the last law of flavor, which is that I love this. Flavor can be created and transformed.
Yes. Well, like we can sense flavors because we produce receptors to pick up on certain molecules. So some molecules we don't have receptors for, so we don't sense them at all. But then there's things you can do, like applying heat to them or doing chemical reactions or biochemical reactions like fermentation, where those molecules are either altered, bits of them are taken off or added on. Sometimes they're sliced up into tiny pieces or reacted together to make, you know, new molecules out of the same tinker toys, essentially. Let's use caramel as an example. When you're making caramel, you're creating flavor on a molecular level. So caramel is just heat applied to sugar. But when you do that, the sugar molecules start breaking down and reacting with each other. So a molecule that like previously was just sweet can undergo changes, break down, pick up new stuff, and then all of a sudden smells like caramel or like vanilla or various other flavors. So when you're creating flavor, you're not creating like new matter. But you're just rearranging, you're rearranging the molecules that you already have into forms that have new tastes and smells.
Very cool. Let me ask you one last question.
Okay.
And it's a question that has plagued me since literally I was a child. So, you know, I grew up eating candy like most kids. And, you know, for instance, like a Jolly Rancher, watermelon Jolly Rancher. And it has its own flavor, right? It has a particular flavor. It's like the candy watermelon flavor or like candy grape flavor.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like it's kind of its own thing. It doesn't really taste a lot like grapes, although Concord grapes maybe a little bit, but whatever. And then I remember eating like a Japanese brand of fruit candy. It was like a melon flavor. And I immediately put it in my mouth and thought, oh my God, it's like I'm eating an incredibly delicious, ripe, juicy piece of melon. What happened? Like, why, you know, why is it like the candy I grew up here, like, you know, the candy version of that flavor just tastes like the candy version of that flavor. But it seems like other people can make candies that actually taste like real fruit. Like, is that like a technological thing? Is that a cultural thing? Like, what happened?
Well, so it's a combination of a cultural thing and a technological thing, I suppose. And I've had a similar experience. If you go to 7-Eleven in Japan for like not very much money, you can get like a shochu highball that might be like,
just like a little drink,
I bought one that was peach flavored, thinking like this might be gross, but like let's try it. And you know when I took the first sip, it was like I could taste the peach skin. It was like more peach than peach. So I guess I focus on flavor, you know, the way that it appears to a cook or, you know, in natural ingredients, like, you know, a vanilla bean makes a lot of flavor molecules. So, you know, let's find a way to use those molecules from that bean. Thinking about flavor like a cook is a bit like, conducting or composing for a symphony. You know, like a flute is going to sound like a flute and you can kind of like tweak it one way or another, but it makes the sound that it makes, and so does a violin. For the flavor of candies, you're not really in the realm of cooking and ingredients. You're in the realm of professional flavorists. And the way that they work is less like playing an instrument and more like making electronic music. So basically starting with pure tone and layering it in different ways so you get a sound that you like that's maybe, you know, a sound that has never been heard before. So, you know, there are like natural flavors that are essentially extracts or distillates. But many, many, many flavors are, you know, tweaked or started from scratch from like pure aroma molecules designed and sort of woven together to get a specific effect. So, yeah, I mean, the flavor industry is very secretive, so I don't know exactly. No one knows. I think it's a complete mysterious trade secret. What the exact molecular profile of you know, honeydew candy is in Asia versus watermelon in the U.S. But
this is incredible. So they have like literally they have just like pure aroma molecule, like in you know whatever, in some solution or whatever
in jars. Yeah, and they take you know. Pipettes and tiny, you know, scales and add 10 micrograms of this thing and like 30 microliters of another and make this sort of completely clear, featureless looking beaker, essentially, that smells like exactly like strawberry. But so there's different layers to it. Like there's some things, for example, like something like imitation vanilla. So if you go and buy like artificial vanilla from the store, that has a molecule called vanillin in it. And vanillin smells like 80% like vanilla. It smells like vanilla. It smells like 80% like a vanilla bean. So it's produced in vanilla beans. It's kind of the like characteristic flavor of vanilla. So it's much simpler in terms of, you know, doing that crazy blending process to kind of just use the one molecule, just be like, all right, we're going to just take vanillin and make a solution of that and ship it out as vanilla flavor. And then there might be some customers that want to get more at the complexity of vanilla, like the other 20% of a vanilla bean flavor that vanillin doesn't cover. And so you can add smaller little bits of these sort of supporting characters to get a more complex vanilla flavor. Yeah. So, you know, there's I think the flavor industry has figured out that there's like one easy to produce molecule that tastes kind of like watermelon and one that, you know, kind of tastes like strawberry and one that kind of tastes like banana. And so a lot of products, candies and stuff use those very simple, easy to produce flavors. But then, where there is a demand for it, they will create much more complicated, multiple smell molecule profiled stuff that takes much more effort but is much more realistic.
That's super cool. Amazing. Thanks so much, Ariel.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was great chatting with you today.
Ariel Johnson is the author of Flavorama, a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. For her recipes for smoked oil and smoked oil poached fish, head to splendidtable.org and go make them because that smoked oil is incredible. And I'll leave you with that. That's our show for the week. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lim Rosetto Casper. It's made each week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review. It really helps us out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.